We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education, with Dan Schwartz, dean of the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford.
Hello, Denise.
Hi, Dan.
So today we're going to be talking about improvisation. And I'm going to ask you, as a teacher, did you ever improvise?
Like every day, every minute.
So like when students ask a question you didn't know, did you improvise?
So I'm one of those teachers who's pretty good at saying, I don't know the answer to that. But you know, I know that teacher rule where I say, what do you think?
Class? Yeah, first move.
Right?
First move, right?
Throw it back to the class. What do you think? Then I'll say, you know, this sounds like something that we should research and find more about. And then assign somebody to do the dirty work.
Really? I'm more badly behaved. I just make stuff up.
Do you make stuff up?
I do.
I literally just said to someone, we put on parent education talks for Challenge Success, and we train people to do it. And I just said literally today, please, when someone asks a question, don't make up an answer. If you don't know, do not make up an answer. So you're breaking a rule there.
No, but you're saying this in the idea that everything has to be factual and true. Maybe my response, I'm making it up, and it's entertaining, it's engaging them in new ideas, as opposed to saying the sun actually rises in the west. You know,
so you admit you're making light of it. You're using humor in the classroom
to save face. Yes,
I think people improvise all the time. I mean, what kind of confuses me is what's the difference between improvisation and, let's say, like what you just did, humor or pretend.
Lying. So, like, I think my son was very good at improvisation because evidently he never did anything I thought he did.
He would just make it up.
He was very good. I'd be like, what are my keys doing in your room? And he would have some elaborate improvisation that was very impressive.
I didn't just happen to take the car when you weren't looking, Dad. Yeah. Well, and then you think, when I think of improvisation too, I think of like sketch comedy or like exercises like Saturday Night Live or those exercises that you do at the beginning of drama class where it's like beep, bop, boop, bop, or you know what I'm talking about?
No, I've got it. So I don't know the boundaries on improvisation. So if you and I are in a debate club and we're taking the two sides, we're sort of improvising with each other.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that counts. I don't know whether I should care if it counts or not. That's why we have a great guest today. We have Dan Klein with us. He is a lecturer in the Graduate School of Business here at Stanford and the Department of Theater and Performing Studies. I assume you're not just lecturing how to market, because I would think that's right. Kind of the theater part. But thank you for coming.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I think the lead question is, what is improvisation? What are the boundaries on it?
The boundaries on improv is a huge question. I think, Denise, you're exactly right. We're improvising all the time. We improvise in everything that we do. I'm improvising right now, as I can tell you guys are somewhat as well. And I think
somewhat badly.
I thought that's what you meant. That's not what I meant. I think that the core of the work that I do is based on theatrical improvisation. And when we define it as a theater performance in front of a live, sometimes paying audience, then it's sort of easy to bound it and say an improvised show is one in which the lines are not predetermined. In fact, the characters, the subject matter, sometimes even the genre or style is wide open and it's left to the moment. But beyond the theater, we use improvisation in everything that we do, and so I think the lines get pretty blurry. There's a big movement right now called applied improvisation. So it's using the techniques essentially cultivated in the theater over the past about 50 or 60 years and applying it to different disciplines. That's how I end up in the business school.
Right. So I think you're going to have to teach us. Denise, you knew this was coming. No, as I understand, failing in front of a huge audience is okay.
Okay.
It's just part of improv.
It's not just okay. It is desired. We want to go after failure. We want to embrace mistakes.
Okay.
It's a big part of this.
I'm your gal then.
All righty. So I get an opportunity to play a game with you guys. Is that where we are right now?
Well, a little bit about – I'm a teacher. I want to teach improv. So maybe a little bit of narrative about what you're doing and as you do it with us.
Absolutely. So there's a really fun exercise that is at the It's an old standby in improv. And we put people in pairs or in trios. We can all three do it together. And what we'll do is we're going to create the world's worst run-on sentence. But we're going to generate the sentence one word at a time around the circle. And it's really important that you recognize, like, the quality of the sentence is not important. But we do want to create an actual sentence. It's not just a string of random words. So we'll try to make some sense, but there's no rule about how good or bad it is. And it'll just go for a little while until I stop it. You guys get the idea there?
Okay, I think so. Dan?
I've already got my 8 words.
Yeah,
oh, no,
right,
see,
good.
That's
yeah.
So, is
right.
That fair? He can't be pre-planning like that.
We call that stockpiling. It's very common. It's normal. But I just recognize that when it comes to you, the word you have planned won't be the most appropriate word. So you'll have to let go of that. But we'll see how that goes. And then usually I will do an exercise and debrief afterwards and talk about the things that had come up in it. Does either of you want to go first, or you want me to go first?
Dan usually likes to go first.
All right, Dan. It was the first word, and we'll go around.
I had to use my stockpile.
Go ahead.
The.
Good.
Busy.
Traffic.
I can't think of anything. Upset.
My.
Daughter.
Who.
Was.
Riding.
With.
A.
Teddy.
Bear.
And.
Looked.
Pretty.
And.
That.
Is.
Lovely.
Sorry. Right, good. We'll stop right there.
So basically, we're ending up with nothing but pronouns and to-be verbs.
I just knew to keep saying and because it was supposed to be a run-on.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. So there's a few things that can pop up if you play this game. One of them, of course, is to recognize that this is not a talking exercise so much as it is a listening exercise. One of the core principles of improvisation is you really need to be paying attention and notice what your partners are doing or saying and listen with your whole body in a way that lets you be present and be able to add the next thing. And we stop listening when we're planning our own thing, or sometimes even worse, if we're judging what we had just said or done, if we're saying, oh, I can't believe I did that, that was awful, or even worse, I just did something brilliant, aren't I amazing? And in that moment, we stop listening.
So I experience cognitive overload. Yeah. I could feel the steam building up in my brain, trying to remember everything. And is this like one of the reasons to do improv? You just get better at hanging on to all this stuff and working with it simultaneously?
I think that's a great point. I mean, one of the things we do is we build a lot of exercises that are designed to create that cognitive overload, partially to get your evaluative brain out of the way. We occupy it with a bunch of stuff so that it can get out of the way, and then you can sort of take on what's the very next thing? What's the thing that's happened right now that I want to add to? So sometimes we'll do an exercise where you'll act out a scene or a story, but at the same time, you need to be counting backwards from 100 in your head as loud as possible.
That is impossible.
Right. Exactly. And you can't do it well. Like the moment you actually do it well.
Excuse me. Do you know that during this, Denise, that I'm figuring out pi to the 93rd digit right now?
I was just going to suggest that let's watch Dan fail again and see if he could do that. No, so what is that doing? What is that actually doing in your brain? Are people able to do that?
People are only able to do it in so much as it short circuits their ability to judge themselves, their ability to plan ahead and to evaluate what has happened or what's going to happen. And so it helps keep people right in the present. There is a quality that the audience can see on stage when someone is really present. They're really there. Keith Johnstone is a brilliant improv and theater director who wrote the book Impro. And he says that a brilliant mind in panic is a joy to watch. And so there's something about seeing someone on that edge that is riveting for an audience.
So this is basically the opposite of school, right, where you're supposed to be in the present, but not you're fully focused, anticipating, very deductive.
In some ways, it is the opposite of school. I like to think of it as a complement to school. But Johnstone said early on he thought, well, maybe it's possible that everything my teachers say, the exact opposite is true. And that's part of how he developed his ideas about improv. He thought as a teacher, he wanted to have all the kids that were the most misbehaved because he thought they were all the ones that teachers said they can't be taught. And he thought, I want them. And the games and exercises that he did absolutely took advantage of the creative spirit and ideas that were bouncing around in those classrooms.
So you've now taught me to improvise. Do you teach me when I shouldn't be improvising? Like, turn it off, Dan. You're about to get in a car accident.
I am lucky that I am brought into situations where people are so high-strung in a sense that I don't have to teach them to stop improvising. I have to give them permission to improvise. That I show up in a context where the ability to be flexible and agile and to be playful and to embrace mistakes, that's the thing that's needed. But I am not – there are times when I want to make sure people are being extremely careful. They're dotting their I's and crossing their T's and doing everything right.
So if I may, I teach the introductory PhD-level statistics course. Mm-hmm. This is a course of great anxiety for the students.
Yes.
It shouldn't be.
Yes.
So I should start the course with improv to
great.
Kind of set the tone, and then hopefully it'll last. I'm probably not going to do improvisation when we're doing square roots or something.
Right. But I do a lot of work with executive education where groups will come to the business school and spend a week on campus learning all different things, accounting and marketing. And I'll do an opening session that'll help put people in a different mode and help them be open to each other and connecting with each other. Mm-hmm. And then anecdotally, it turns out they get a lot more out of that week. They feel like they open their minds in a different way. They start seeing their colleagues and classmates not as competitors but as partners and teammates. And so absolutely, I think any subject benefits from an opening experience and as well as reminders along the way, a little improv game to start a class here and there will help bring people back together again.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Dan Klein about improvisation, applied improvisation. So I have a question, Dan. Do you find that when people use this in school settings, kids who would be afraid to fail are more engaged? What I see is kids who are really intense on getting really good grades,
yeah,
not making a mistake, being perfect,
yeah,
and just tell me what to say.
Mm-hmm.
Let me parrot it back. And I don't want to try and do this harder stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like improvisation is a great way to teach the growth mindset, the Carol Dweck idea that we can learn anything if we allow ourselves to believe that we can, that there's not a fixed set. That what you just described where people are afraid to take on something harder, it usually comes from the fact they think, well, it'll show whether or not I'm good at this. My intelligence is set, and if I take on a hard thing, maybe it'll show that I'm not that intelligent, so I don't want to challenge myself. Improvisation says we all are on a path. We're all growing and getting better, and we embrace making mistakes and failing and celebrate failure, and we're able to the idea is that if we can change our response to mistakes, change our attitude and approach to when we fail, then we're able to take on so many more things. We can do it more cheerfully, more pleasurably, and also achieve much greater success in the end.
Improv strikes me as a particular brand of creative production.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm writing,
yeah,
I'd say it's very solitary.
Mm-hmm.
Improv is very social.
Yes.
And so how do you get people to sort of let go of saving face of I want to be right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you like fail first for them so they see it's okay?
Absolutely. I think that's a great way to do it. I mean, I learned from – my teacher was Patricia Ryan Madsen, who wrote the book Improv Wisdom, and she was my mentor. And she really taught me that – our job as teachers is to make it a safe place for students to take risks. And sometimes that means messing up ourselves. Sometimes that means lowering the intensity of whatever we're asking them to do. Say, oh, let's give it a try, see what happens. Sometimes it means taking on responsibility. Say, if this doesn't go well, it's my fault. I'm the teacher. I'm the one who should know how this is. So blame me if you have a bad experience.
So in the example that we did where Dan said, I can't think of anything. He went, I can't think of anything. and we just kind of you gave him some time and we kept going.
Yeah.
What if a kid just, you know, that's it. I'm out. I can't think of anything. I'm bad at improv.
So, yeah. For example, one of my favorites, a student was defending her dissertation, you know, in front of faculty and audience. And after about 1 minute, she lost it. She had to leave the room and go cry. It's high pressure. Yeah. Well, to her credit, she came back and finished beautifully.
Right.
But she's shy. The stress is high. Yeah. You know,
Even in that little exercise, my heart was pounding. Yeah. I'm serious.
Oh, yeah.
I don't use like it was.
You did
pounding.
Great. You did great.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thanks, because Dan, you failed. I just want to point that out.
No, I know.
Beautifully, you guys both exhibited all the skills that we're looking for. I think that there's a lot of this is about fear. Keith Johnstone talks about our goal is to reduce fear when we're up in front of people, and it's scary to be in front of people. It's a universal experience when a human is standing. Or sitting in front of a group of mammals that are staring at them, our hearts start to race. And anything we can do to minimize the fear. So I love the story that you told about the student who had to leave the room and come back because she finished beautifully. The story isn't over the moment you say, oh, I can't do it. The story is much longer than that in a sense. And so part of it is early on in the classroom, I set people up with a game that they're going to fail at. It just count back and forth to three as fast as you can, alternating. And they're just going to mess up. And then I coach them on what to do when they mess up and how to laugh at the natural response, which is to hide or to cover or cower, and try and do the exact opposite and celebrate failure. And I'm having people do it really physically and boldly, and I have the whole room cheer when someone messes up so that we're kind of conditioning, like, these are different rules here. I really believe that my purpose in life might be here at Stanford to teach high achievers to shoot for average and fail cheerfully.
All right. This is School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're speaking with Dan Klein. And up next, more on applying improvisation to school and life.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back. I'm Denise here with Dan, and we are speaking with another Dan, Dan Klein, about applying the techniques of improvisation.
I'd like to follow up from before. So I'm trying to figure out what improvisation is great for. So there's a lot of competition for time in the classroom, time at home, and I'm trying to make decisions about when to use things. And we were saying improvisation is a good way to help people learn to tolerate or embrace failure. To me, it seems very social. It seems like it is about learning to interact with people and when you may not want to, when you're out of your comfort zone. But I'm not thinking of failure at that moment. I'm just thinking I'm interacting with someone. It's like the high social stress.
Yeah, I think that improvisation really is – it's easy for it to tend towards extroverted participants, that people who really like that social dynamic. And even if they're a shy extrovert, they get an opportunity to say, oh, this is an excuse. I get someone to push me in some rules to play a game. I think that it also has incredible value for introverts, but it's a lot – it feels different. It shows up different. And I think it's a great exercise to give people who are potentially more solitary, who sort of draw energy from being by themselves, it gives them a chance to explore different techniques and ways of interacting and ways of adapting their own self-evaluation in the moment. I think that improv – if I just have a classroom full of extroverts, I actually don't love it. It's easy enough to do. I say, let's do this, and they all jump up and do it. It's a great exercise for introverts because they do have to learn listening. It's 80% listening, and that's something they have to learn. But I love to have a mixed classroom with introverts and extroverts. I love having shy students who, again, shy being a different category than introvert, but with a lot of overlap, because they get an opportunity to pay attention, to sometimes get the spotlight and see what happens when they're there. And then they have a group around them whose only rule is to make your partner look good. And there's an amazing thing that happens with an individual when you realize that anything that I say or do will be celebrated and accepted and built on by my colleagues or my classmates, then more things emerge.
So that's one of the rules that I used to remember from improv is that you just have to go with it. You can't say no, right? So you don't say, okay, Dan, that was stupid.
That's right.
I'm not going to take your suggestion.
Exactly.
Right? So are there things that you teach before you go into an exercise to help that really painfully shy person or the person who's really afraid to do this? I'm thinking of a teacher who might want to apply this in their classroom. Mm-hmm. Is there some warnings or some tips?
I do a lot of exercises that are everybody doing it together at the same time in their own spot in the room, so nobody's watching you. Everyone's focused on their own thing. I do a lot of exercises at the beginning that don't require people to speak. They're all nonverbal. So we put so much pressure on ourselves when we're about to open our mouth. But if I do an exercise where we just have people walking around the room, paying attention to each other, and I say the rule is you can't speak, it's a lot easier for me to get everyone involved. And then I can bring up these points about standing up for your partner and making other people look good without having put someone on the spot and have them have to be self-deprecating in front of the group in order to feel safer.
That's great. Those are great suggestions.
So as a parent, do I want to do improvisation? Like, I know very young children doing pretend play is a way for them to sort of imagine and things that aren't right in front of them.
I think improvisation with young children is a must. I think it's a great thing for parents to do. I taught middle school for a long time right out of college, and I think that my job when I'm working with kids is not to teach them how to be creative, but my job is to celebrate their creativity and honor it in such a way that they're more likely to carry it through whatever transitions they'll go through as they grow up. But honestly, as a parent, I think playing and improvising with your children, it's just great for you. You get to discover creativity and imagination in a whole new way.
So is there like a improvisation coloring book that parents can get or something to help them with these routines?
I would definitely look at Patricia Ryan Madsen's book, Improv Wisdom. It's a great book about improv in life, not on stage. But I would also recommend Lawrence Cohen's book, Playful Parenting. It's a great book about this mode of interaction with your kids, not just for fun, cool, interesting stuff, but also the challenging things that come up between adults and children.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Dan Klein about improvisation, and we're talking about improvisation maybe in the family, maybe for using it at home. You suggested some great books. What might that look like? When would be sort of an appropriate time?
That's interesting because my first instinct is to say take advantage of whenever the moment presents itself. It may be sitting at the dinner table that there's a game that arises. And at the same time, I'm not advocating that you do a food fight just because that would be saying yes to something that developed. But I do think that any time you have an opportunity to get down on the floor, that really makes a big difference. Again, this is something that comes from the book Playful Parenting. But at every stage of the child's development, when the parent can get on the floor with the kid, it sends a huge signal that we're playing in your zone and you get more agency now.
So what does that mean, get on the floor with the kid? So I'm picturing like my 15-year-old who's bigger than me. What does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know for sure about 15. Okay. My son's 16 and we haven't gotten on the floor in a little while. But conceptually sort of I do like to get into his space. I like to – he plays video games as a lot of teenage boys do. But it's fun for me sometimes to drop into his world and play the game with him. And so in a sense, our avatars might get on the floor. Mm. I think that the opportunity to play any kind of game where you're making stuff up should be taken advantage of. I could show you guys a game right now, a storytelling game. Do we have a moment?
Yeah, if it's quick, we can do it.
It's pretty quick. It goes like this. This comes from Ken Adams, and it's called The Story Spine. And it's a way to make up a story. It starts, I'll give you the first phrase, and you guys will go around the circle completing the phrase. First one is once upon a time. Either of you want to start? Once upon a time, there was
a princess in an enchanted forest.
And every day, that princess,
she would go outside and sing to the birds.
Until one day,
a bird ate her.
And because the bird ate her,
he had a really bad stomach ache.
And because the bird had a stomach ache,
turned out the bird learned to sing.
And ever since that day,
the bird had the voice of the princess.
And the moral of this story is,
don't get eaten.
I'm so glad that Dan had to come up with the moral and not me. I'm so glad that Dan had to come up with the moral.
Okay.
So when would you use that, right? What's the point of that exercise?
I think the idea of collaborative storytelling, I believe, is in a sense it's the ultimate improv. It's what we're doing when we're working together. We're making up a story together. We're creating characters that we care about and see what happens next to them. And we're building on each other's ideas. It's great in the classroom. It might be great to develop language arts. It's great at home to develop a connection and a shared experience. If the story doesn't work and we just fall apart and laugh about it, even that ends up being a great bonding experience.
That's great. So I have one question I have to ask. So there can't be a lot of research on the benefits of improvisation. So let's design the study. You have now taught a middle school course for a year on improvisation. What's the study you'd like me to do? Like, go look at these kids 2 years later to see, did they go into drama or do they have better social skills? We picked up more of the shy kids.
This is such a great question. I think that whether or not they go into drama isn't the test for me. Great. If they become actors and performers, I'd be very proud and excited about that. But that's not what I'm shooting for. But what is their success on group projects, on team projects? How are they – if there's some way that we could test how they're working with others. I don't know if there's a way to look at their social network and determine what role do they seem to play? How many people are they connected to? And do people go to them to share empathetic stories? Like what's – that would be really interesting to me.
We could do that.
Let's do that.
We could do that.
Thank you so much, Dan, for being a fabulous guest. I learned so much, and my heart is still a little bit pounding, but it was really fun.
My pleasure.
Don't get eaten by a bird. Was that the moral of the story?
Moral of the whole show, Dan? What did you learn from the show, Dan?
Well, I think improvisation sounds like a great set of routines to help people have, you know, very involved social interactions, get to hear each other, get to say what's on their mind, and you don't get to do that in school a lot.
And to make school fun and engaging. So I like that part too.
Unless you're shy.
You're listening to School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.